counters are hitting the streets in a handful of Valley cities today for a special mid-decade census. It's expensive, but the cities say it's worth it.
We believe that our community has grown by about 11%, and the first year, we will recoup that expense.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, bus drivers vote to authorize a strike in Phoenix. Arizona is starting to be a hotbed of entrepreneurship.
Efforts to give English language learners a more well-rounded education.
And in this drought, could cacti come to the rescue?
Prickly pears could certainly be much more efficient at water usage and incorporating the water being used into biomass.
Plus, the evolution of Phoenix's art scene over the past three decades, and we work up a sweat.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay sunny and hot for the rest of today, and then we'll see a little bit of a turn in the weather. Clear skies tonight with lows in the mid-70s. Sunny tomorrow, not quite as warm, with highs only in the upper 90s. Currently with relative humidity at 12%, clear skies and 103 degrees.
Another state audit has found problems with the Department of Child Safety's process for removing children from their homes. This review, released Wednesday, is the latest in a series of reports over the past few months. They all point to the same issue, inconsistent decision-making guidelines. Democratic State Representative Eric Meyer is losing confidence in leadership. He says the agency has already asked the legislature for more money next year.
It's hard to give them more money. Their budget's already $800 million. How much money will they need, and will money make a difference? Is it the fact that the leadership that's in place can't handle the problem?
The department has developed a strategic plan. They did that over the summer to address issues pointed out in the audits, but policies haven't been implemented yet.
A bus strike is looming in Phoenix after members of the Amalgamated Transit Union voted overwhelmingly to authorize a work stoppage for 700 drivers who operate many of the city's busiest routes. KJZZ's Phil Atzman joins us now with more. And Phil, what is going on?
Well, Steve, those who rely on public bus service in Phoenix may soon have to find another way to get around ongoing negotiations between the drivers' union and French-based company Transdev that contracts with the city of Phoenix for the majority of its bus service. Have broken down, and those drivers are now officially working without a contract. Last night, union members gave the green light for a strike by 95% margin. Meanwhile, Transdev has now submitted what it calls its last and final offer. I spoke this morning with Robert Bean, who is president of the ATU's Local 1433, about where things stand.
We started negotiations back in April and May and have been going since then. We met 25 times with the company, and it's the same thing as it was 5 years ago with this company. They want to protect the profit that they're making off the city of Phoenix, and they want to protect that by taking it off the backs of the workers. So it got to the point, the contract was due to expire at midnight last night, so we had to have some kind of a voice from the membership. So we ran the strike authorization vote yesterday, and it was heavy turnout, and 95% said they've given me authorization to call a strike.
You authorized this work stoppage, this strike, and then you've got the last and final offer, as you say, from Transdev. Have you had a chance to look over that last and final offer?
I got the strike authorization, and Transdev dropped the best and final on us just before 9 o'clock last night, just before we counted the vote. So the memberships have not seen the best and final yet. That will be going to a ratification vote for them next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And what I've seen so far, it's garbage.
How far apart are you? I mean, is this any closer to being resolved with this last and final? Or, as you said, it's garbage, and from what you can see, it's not going to be worked with?
There's a lot of issues in there that I could not recommend to the membership whatsoever. It's closer than I thought we would be, but it's still miles apart.
What do you say to the bus riders who may be stuck, unable to get to work, get to school? Obviously, you don't want to see that happen. What do you say to them if it does happen?
Well, we always maintain that we want to keep the buses moving because we don't want the public to be put out by it. But if push comes to shove, we're going to have to call a strike, and hopefully it won't be a long one again, but they're going to have to look for alternate transportation. light rail's running. There is other buses that run east and west, the north and north and south. Just the major bus lines are the ones that will be affected. But we're hoping that we can get this solved before we have to take the drivers out.
That is Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1433 President Bob Bean. And Steve, it should be noted that Transdev is the same company that operates bus routes in Tucson that only recently settled after a 45-day work stoppage there.
So, Phil, now that they've authorized this, when might drivers walk off the job?
Not until they vote on this last and final offer, and union members are scheduled to do that by Friday of next week. That's October 9th, so it wouldn't be till after that. But as Bean just told me, his first impressions of the offer are that it's, quote, garbage, and that he would not recommend his members to vote for it.
And how many riders could be affected by this in Phoenix?
Hard to give an exact number, but a strike would affect the majority of them. 34 of Phoenix's 49 bus routes would disrupt service citywide. The city says it averages 128,000 boardings per day for those routes.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman with news on another possible bus strike in Arizona. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Steve.
Seven Valley cities and towns start a special mid-decade census today. The municipalities are undertaking the federal count because of significant population growth. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan has been following this issue and is with me. So, Alex, why are the cities doing the census?
Because of state shared revenues, it's money that's been collected from transportation taxes, highway taxes, and then the state distributes that to different cities. Now, that calculation has always been done based on census population estimates that happen every 10 years. But these seven cities feel like their population has grown significantly enough since the last census that they need a new count so that they can get a larger share of the state money.
They don't want to wait another 5 years to have to get the next census done so they can account for that population growth.
Exactly.
Have these cities done something like this before?
Yes, but it's pretty expensive. These cities are paying for it themselves. But previously, the last four decades, there's been a regional census, and so that's sort of helped defray some of the cost. But some of the bigger cities like Phoenix and Mesa that didn't experience that much population growth didn't want to do that again. So these smaller cities took on doing the special census themselves, but they feel like even though the cost is expensive in the millions, the money that they will get from the state shared revenues because of their larger population will be a net gain.
So which are the seven cities that are doing this?
Peoria, Buckeye, Goodyear, Gilbert, Chandler, Surprise, and Queen Creek.
Why doesn't Arizona use state numbers to distribute this money?
Because the way the law is written. But a coalition of cities and towns, including those who are doing the special census and those who aren't, are hoping to change that with a law next legislative session. They want to introduce a bill that would use annual state population estimates. Demographers down at the University of Arizona are working on a formula and methodology to come up with these state estimates.
So every city would have this done every single year and the money would be allocated based on that.
Exactly.
Do we have a sense of what cities who will get extra money as a result of this special census will do with that extra cash?
The money goes into the general fund, so the cities can use it for whatever they want. But most of the cities that I've talked to plan to use it for infrastructure improvements because a lot of these cities have experienced pretty rapid population growth. They need to keep up with the number of people that are living in their town.
KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan. Alex, thanks.
Thank you.
One of the cities Alexandra mentioned that's starting a special census today is Buckeye. George Diaz is Buckeye's government relations manager. And George, what's going on today on the streets of your city?
Mark, we have about 145 enumerators going into our community, manually counting the number of residents that we have for the purposes of increasing our state shared revenue allocation.
How much is this operation costing the city?
Last year, I believe it was October 22nd, the council voted to spend $1.4 million towards this effort. Now, the reason or the rationale for spending that much money on this is that we believe that our community has grown by about 11%, and the first year we will recoup that expense. So that $1.5 to $2 million additional per year for the next 5 years. That's what it'll equate to.
How do you know how much the city has grown? Obviously, there was a census done in 2010, but what gives you the idea that the growth in Buckeye has been as strong as it has been over the last 5 years?
So how did we justify that the expense without knowing with any certainty whether we'd grown by that amount, right? Well, there are certain estimates that are conducted annually. MAG, the Maricopa Association of Governments, conducts estimates. But the way we confirmed that was with the number of sanitation accounts, or the increase in sanitation accounts over the last 5 years. We may have an increase in homes, but that doesn't mean anybody's living there. So water is one way, sanitation accounts are, is another way.
People who have signed up for city services.
That's right. And occasionally you might have a home that will subscribe to water service for the purposes of maintaining their landscape, you know, while they're away for the summertime. We have a lot of seasonal visitors. But when they have a sanitation account, that gives us a stronger indication that they're permanent residents and we can count on them being there over the next month to count them.
Do you have a sense yet of what projects will get funded with this extra state shared revenue that you're hopefully going to get?
Yeah, I wish we could say that it was a sort of special project that we were anticipating to fund with this. But because we've had that growth in our population, we're just looking at catching up on some of those services that are critical to our residents, like fire, police, parks, libraries, those kinds of things. So we don't have any special project in mind.
How long do you expect it to take to conduct this special census?
Hopefully we'll be wrapped up by Thanksgiving, so about a month and a half.
And at what point do you find out if what the enumerators find matches the projections that the city has?
We'll know very soon. We will know very soon after the conclusion of the special census what we can expect in the way of a number. It shouldn't take more than a couple of weeks. That's what we've been told anyway.
George Diaz is Buckeye's government relations manager. The city is among seven starting a special mid-decade census today. The architecture site Arkonect recently announced the winners of its Dry Futures competition. It asked architects to submit ideas for dealing with California's drought and divided the responses into two categories, pragmatic and speculative. The winning pragmatic entry called for placing drains around the San Fernando Valley to replenish the underground aquifer. The winner of the speculative category imagines massive farms of Nopalis cacti as a source of food and water treatment. Amelia Taylor-Hochberg is the editorial manager for Arkonect.com.
For our perspective and working with architects, we wanted to try to leverage the specific perspective and intelligence that the architecture community has to put together a series of ideas that could help not necessarily solve the drought as it is, because we're not even sure whether the drought can be solved, but that we wanted to kind of leverage the architecture community's intelligences to understand creative ideas for how to live with this drought and how to mitigate its negative effects.
What were you looking for as far as judging who would be the winners in each category?
So myself, I was not a judge. We had a fantastic jury of a variety of professionals, some explicitly architects, but many not. And so I can't speak directly to their ideas and how they evaluated the submission. However, I do know that when we spoke to them and when we talked about what we would like to kind of see in these submissions, we did push on the idea of having that line straddle between speculative and pragmatic, because we knew that we really wanted us to stay in the ideas competition. We didn't imagine that people would only be submitting truly pragmatic, currently possible ideas or proposals. We really wanted to kind of straddle that line.
Well, given that, I mean, how realistic do you think that some of the winning ideas are? I mean, do you expect at some point in the future that we'll have prickly pear cactus farms to try to alleviate the drought somewhat?
I think many of the submissions, both winning and not, contain kernels of highly possible, if not eminently possible, and doable, feasible ideas. Such as the research behind the cactivism proposal, there is ongoing research to that end that is quite promising. We can totally see that if things continue positively, that could very well become a kernel of an idea and another entirely real proposal. One of the winning proposals included the creation of a digital currency for water. So those kinds of ideas are also entirely possible. They're just, in some ways, much more radical because they require not just the political weight behind them to actually have them happen and be implemented, but also a huge cultural and social shift in the population to accept those ideas.
It also seemed that while some of the ideas were specific to particular parts of California, there are others that were among the winners that could be exported elsewhere, that could be used in places like Arizona, for example.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we were very aware that for the sake of our competition, we wanted to make it specific and wanted to focus on California because that's what we were most familiar with. However, you know, California's biome is unique, but it's not so unique that same ideas can't be applied to other drought-stricken and otherwise just dry areas.
Amelia Taylor-Hochberg is the editorial manager for Arconect.com, which ran the Dry Futures competition. So can prickly pears help deal with the drought? Lucas Majeur, who works on the plant at Desert Botanical Garden, says, yeah, maybe.
So that's, yeah, a very interesting question. And, you know, I think in terms of areas that previously might have been heavily irrigated using things like alfalfa and other sort of high water use species, prickly pears could certainly be much more efficient at water usage and incorporating the water being used into biomass. So I think certainly it's a very interesting and plausible idea.
Do you envision that at some point we might see cactus farms, Nopalis prickly pear farms, where they're produced as food for both humans and animals and also used as basically a water treatment system?
I certainly hope so. The U.S. is somewhat behind the times in those terms because, for instance, people in Mexico have been using prickly pears for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years in plantation types of systems for the production of fodder for animals and the production of vegetable sources, nopales, for consumption, as well as the tunas, the fruits that are eaten from those that are produced. In terms of actually using the biomass produced from prickly pears to clean up water sources, that's a very interesting topic. And it's one that has received a certain amount of research. There are a number of papers published, one specifically noting the usage of prickly pear biomass to reduce the amount of heavy metals in contaminated water.
Would the water be clean enough to make it drinkable, or are we just talking about making it clean enough to use in irrigation or some other type of use?
Yeah, that's, in my mind, that's not totally clear. You know, would it actually be potable after treating it with the proteins and fibers from Opuntia's prickly pear cacti? I'm not totally sure. Certainly, it would be clean enough, I would presume, to be used in other forms, such as irrigation.
How many prickly pears would you need? How big would these farms have to be, do you think, assuming that the water treatment system would actually work, to make much of a difference?
Yeah, I think they would have to be relatively massive just to produce enough biomass to have this sort of three-tier system where you know, take a portion and you use that for human consumption, another portion use that for animal consumption, and then a third portion of the biomass produced to use for water cleaning.
I have to say that when I first read about this, my first reaction was, this seems like such a simple solution. I mean, prickly pears have been here forever. Why have we not been doing this already?
You know, I think that's an incredibly good and interesting comment because, you know, in other parts of the world, they have been doing this for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So why have we been slower to get on the bandwagon and actually incorporate more eco-friendly, desert-friendly species into our agricultural production? I think part of that might be slightly cultural because we're just not used to planting things like cacti for, you know, agricultural products. We think of those as, you know, they're really beautiful to have in our lawns and to use as ornamentals, but we don't really think of those as consumables when in reality, not just prickly pears, but a number of species of the family Cactaceae have been used for thousands of years for this type of purpose, at least in terms of human consumption and animal consumption.
The contest for which this idea was submitted was based in California, but is it safe to say that if it would work theoretically in California, there's no reason to think it wouldn't work here as well?
I think certainly in specific parts of Arizona, you know, especially in areas that are now fallow, you know, that haven't been used for agriculture for a number of years due to, you know, problems with water resources. It could certainly be experimented with here in Arizona, and it would be interesting to try that out.
Lucas Majeure studies prickly pear cacti at Desert Botanical Garden. If you want to read more about what the author called grassroots cactivism or see the other winning entries in the Dry Futures contest, we'll have a link at theshow.kjzz.org. Coming up, Arizona's beginning to take a leadership position nationwide in job creation from startups.
Because we are such a young place and we really support this innovation and risk-taking, those are two things that are really helpful.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. We will stay sunny and well above normal. We're currently at 103 degrees in the valley. It'll cool off a bit tomorrow with a high of 98, and then on Saturday, sunny skies with a high of 97. In valley traffic, there's an accident blocking the shoulder. It's on the I-10 eastbound at Southern Avenue. It's 224.
KJZZ is supported by Landings Credit Union, helping kids learn about money with youth accounts, because one day they'll need a car loan, a credit card, and a mortgage for a new home. LandingsCU.org. Landings Credit Union. Banking with purpose.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with the takeaways. Todd Zwillick. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The Y2K of medicine. That's how some doctors are describing the rollout of a whole new payment system that begins today. Previously, when you went to the doctor's office sent a claim to your insurance company to get paid. And there's a big system of codes that correspond to certain procedures or illnesses like a broken wrist or strep throat.
But today, doctors and hospitals all across the country are getting a new set of codes and a whole lot of new options. The old system had just 14,000 codes, the new one, 70,000.
And all the new codes, they're really specific. There's even one for getting sucked into a jet engine. So apart from airport workers, I guess, how does this affect doctors and insurers and patients? Joining us is Dr. Michael Marks. He's an orthopedic surgeon and healthcare consultant. Dr. Marks, welcome.
Hi there, Todd.
The Y2K of doctors' offices, is that fair?
Well, actually, I don't think that actually goes far enough. Y2K turned out to be not much of anything. I think this is really actually going to be something. And the data and statistics actually is probably more than 91,000 diagnostic codes that are going to have to be utilized starting tomorrow, October 1st.
Okay, fair enough. But big doctors' offices do have professionals who speak the language of these codes. It's their job to get the codes in the forms, to get the doctor's office paid. So you already have those people in a lot of offices. Can't they do this?
Well, the actual answer to that is maybe. And obviously, we're going to find out going forward. But as you mentioned, this is a lot about increased specificity, which is how you wind up increasing the number of codes. So in the world of orthopedics, and the orthopedic surgeons probably been hit the hardest by all this, 65% of those more than 91,000 codes are going to affect them. And that's because for the first time, we're talking about laterality. Was it the right wrist or the left wrist that was broken? So a coder can only code if the doctor or other healthcare provider is putting the specificity in there to be able to them to code it.
Now, what's the virtue of making this language so much more specific? I understand that it's less convenient. I understand there's a lot more words to know if you want to call it a language, but what's the advantage here?
Well, the whole coding system is actually developed by epidemiologists, and they want to know data, statistics for societal resources going forward. So this generation of healthcare providers probably will not see much upside to this increased specificity. Maybe 15, 20, 25 years from now, they'll find out that, wow, look at that. It seems that 90% of the carpal tunnels are on the right than on the left. Why is that happening?
I have a long history myself of covering medicine and covering doctors, and it seems like almost every step of the way, doctors resist change. Doctors resisted, in a lot of cases, electronic medical records. They certainly resisted, in a lot of cases, the changes in Obamacare. They've resisted Medicare changes. This seems like another case of improvement in record keeping or practice that doctors just don't like because they want to be left alone.
Well, I don't think it's as much that, but the last industrialized country, and I don't want you to fall off your chair when I tell you this, but the last industrialized country to move to ICD-10 was Canada. And that was back in 2000. We're now going live with it. We've kicked the can down the road a couple of times. But in this country, coding is done by individual hospitals. It's done by individual providers. In Canada, ICD-10 is only used on the inpatient side, as I understand it, and all the coders are government employees. So I'm not saying that the system is wrong, but it becomes another unfunded mandate. And so because it's not necessarily set up the correct way, I've been going to my Facebook account and communicating with people and lecturing all over the country to say, look, let your patients know that there may be some glitches in all of this where claims may get denied. We don't 100% know if all the insurers are going to be up to speed, all the EMRs are up to speed. So I think it's the fear of Y2K, but just that much times larger.
That's Dr. Michael Marks, orthopedic surgeon and healthcare consultant. Dr. Marks, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
Arizona ranks in the top 10 nationally the number of jobs created from startups. New numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau show in 2013, 2.3% of the jobs created in Arizona were at such companies. Other Western states were also among the national leaders that year. Sydney Peck is the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the W.E.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
A lot that's going into what Arizona has become in the startup space, and I would love to see numbers from 2014 and this year as well, because I think they would be pretty incredible. But a few things, a few buckets that we can put it in. We have a lot of momentum and support from the key players that make a really ripe entrepreneurship environment. And number one is support from city and state government. You see the universities, and the next bucket being our incubator programs. And then the most important piece of this puzzle, but the final bucket, are our entrepreneurs. So there's a lot going on.
Are you finding that the money for investing in these startups is coming from this area, or is it still coming from elsewhere?
Well, you know, it's interesting. On this map that they have here from the census, the areas where we see the most growth is where the money is coming from. So what's really cool that's started happening is that there's been a lot of regional investment. So it used to be the standard that investors really wanted to invest in companies that they could get in their car and drive to, that they could go on site and visit. And that's changing. There's a lot of regional investment happening, and that's really beneficial for places like Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, where wealth may or may not already be in the state, but it would be great if we can share it amongst ourselves, also with California and other states who are actively investing. So it's very high regional activity that we're seeing, and we are also seeing significant investment from Arizona as our Desert Angels continue to be in the top five most active angel groups in the country.
Are there particular industries or types of startups that we're seeing more of in Arizona?
You know, we see a lot of technology. There's a lot around clean energy, a lot in the life sciences and biospace. So we're keeping up with, again, our regional peers that we see and the things that create the most opportunity or are taking advantage of the most opportunity and highly scalable businesses. But we're seeing a significant growth in technology.
Do you think the number of startups, the number of jobs created from startups in Arizona is in any way a reflection of how badly the state was hit during the recession and the number of jobs that were lost during that time?
So I don't know that it's a result of how, I guess you're saying how far we were knocked down and it's easier to get back up. You know, we saw that in real estate from a standpoint, you know, the lower we dropped, we seemed to make a pretty swift recovery because we had to get back on par. But, you know, in general, what I would say is that because Arizona is an affordable place to live and because we are a young environment that's open to, you know, failures and getting back up on your feet, and we're very supportive of people trying things, and if they don't work, trying something different, because we are such a young place and we really support this innovation and risk-taking. Those are two things that are really helpful. So cost of living is important. I wouldn't say that it's because we came from such a deep dive in the recession, but I think, I mean, this is just the nature of the people who are flocking to Arizona and specifically to the Phoenix metro area right now. We are a hotbed for entrepreneurship, and we have so many resources and positive things happening here, and it's a great environment to do it. So I think it's really driving people here.
And it sounds like you expect this trend to continue.
I do. So like I said, this information that we have up until 2013, I think, was right when things were really starting to catch fire. And organizational activity and momentum that I've seen has really been significant in 2014 and this year. So I can't wait to see the numbers as they come in over the next couple of years, and I think it's only going to continue to get better.
Sydney Peck is director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Sydney, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Arts in the Phoenix area have dramatically changed over the past three-plus decades. Part of that has to do with a population that's nearly doubled from nearly 790,000 to about 1.5 million. And the new arrivals have brought their own diverse perspectives about what art is and how many offerings we should have. At the early stage of that dramatic growth, the city started the Phoenix Arts and Culture Commission, which is marking its 30th anniversary this month. Dwight Wolf is Director of Grant Services and Community Initiatives for the Phoenix Office of Arts and Culture. Dwight, what's the biggest reason you see for the expansion of arts opportunities in the city of Phoenix?
I think the most dramatic impact has been the bond process that the city has offered, and Phoenix residents have approved bonds in 2001 and in 2006. And as part of the bonds, those two bonds, there was about $60 million, each of those two bonds, that was specific for cultural facilities. And as a result of that, we were able to build new cultural facilities. And so we build the buildings and the organizations. We enter into contracts, operating agreements with the organizations to go in and operate the buildings. And so one of the new things we do now is that I serve as the city's property manager for these cultural facilities. Yeah.
How much can the facility affect not only how attendees view the event, but also how an arts company feels about itself and its prospects?
Well, I can tell you that the new buildings for the Arizona Opera and Ballet Arizona have had dramatic effects for those organizations. Arizona Opera has a building right across the street now from the Phoenix Art Museum. And when they went in, some of the businesses along Central Avenue said, well, you know, it's become really this arts corridor, and so we ought to be naming it as sort of an arts district. And then with Ballet Arizona, you know, they had been working for years out of a little strip mall over on Indian School and I think 36th Street or something. Right. They couldn't really rehearse full out like they would on the symphony stage. Well, what we did with the ballet building is we were able to give them seven studios that are the size of Symphony Hall stage so that they can fully, you know, block out, choreograph out, dance full out as they would on stage.
How important are diversity of arts and accessibility to the arts?
What we're really about is making sure that the diversity of the community is represented through their artistic cultures. We fund a lot of festivals and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We try to make sure that those communities that don't have the kind of access that others may have to engaging in arts and cultural opportunity, that they have that access. And the underwriting that we do through our grants is about creating that sort of access.
Is there something that really grabbed you about wanting to be so deeply involved?
Well, I'm an artist myself. I've always had musical talent, and so really I'm one of those people who, you know, from junior high, I guess it was, literally knew that this was going to be the course for me, and I was going to perform. And I got involved with this and found out that I just really loved working with the organizations. The organizations, you know, are employing so many artists, helping them to do their mission to provide services to the city, to provide services and an opportunity for the artists involved.
Dwight Wolf is Director of Grant Services and Community Initiatives for the Phoenix Office of Arts and Culture. On Saturday at the Convention Center and the Herberger Theater, there will be a celebration of Phoenix Arts and Culture. Coming up, students learning English may not have to spend as much time in immersion programs.
One child may acquire a language sooner than another. So acquiring a language is very personal.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound and a collision on the 7th Avenue on-ramp. Also I-10 eastbound, a collision at Southern. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 105 today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in mid-70s. Sunny tomorrow, cooling down a bit to 98 degrees. Right now under sunny skies, 103 at KJZZ at 238.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, specialists who develop innovative transplant solutions for patients from around the world, right here in Phoenix. More about transplant programs at mayoclinic.org.
In KJZZ News, two men have been convicted of murder in the southern Arizona killing of a Border Patrol agent whose death brought to light the bungled federal gun tracking operation known as Fast and Furious. The jury took only 3.5 hours to find Jesus Leonel Sanchez Mesa and Ivan Soto Barraza guilty of all counts in the killing of Agent Brian Terry in 2010. They now face sentences of life in prison.
Thanks to a change or refinement approved by the State Board of Education, Arizona schools have a little more freedom when it comes to how much time English language learners need to spend in an immersion program. It's no longer mandatory for an ELL student to be in an immersion block for 4 hours in the school day. Critics say the old system kept middle and high schoolers from expanding their knowledge in other classes. Evie Cortez-Platenik is Director of Language Acquisition for Phoenix Union High School District. And Evie, how did this come about?
Last May, we were told that we were going to be given what the State Department calls a refinement, an approved refinement to the SEI model. That particular refinement has two versions, an elementary and a secondary. The version that applies to the secondary, what they have given us permission to do is to reduce the model by 2 hours if the students meet a certain criteria.
Can you tell us more about the criteria and how it's determined that a student is ready to move on to that?
Let me just say that the refinement for secondary model is really not different than what we have been doing in the past. Because in the past, if the student was in their second year of intermediate and they had scored proficient in the reading and writing on the Azella test, we were allowed to reduce the model. What this refinement does for us is that the child no longer has to be in their second year of intermediate. They can just be in their second year of an English language development program.
Were you seeing anything in the past that indicated that some students who were ELL students were missing out on certain other opportunities? Do you feel like this could ramp them up a little bit better?
What the four-hour model does for the high school level is that the kids only have 6 periods a day. So 4 hours are consumed with the four-hour model, which means the kids only have 2 additional hours to take core content classes that they need toward graduation. So typically, the kids in ELL do not graduate in 4 years. Although it is not impossible, they would have to do a lot of extra things that other kids don't have to do in order to graduate with their cohort.
Do you feel like the standards are good enough to know whether the student is communicating enough, is getting it enough in English to make sure that they won't fall behind in communication as they're able to try some of the other classes, try some of the electives, as the immersion is no longer 4 hours?
That would depend on the child because, as I often try to emphasize, we're not a factory. So we don't produce the same product over and over and over and over and over again. Every child learns differently at different rates, and the same is true for language acquisition. One child may acquire a language sooner than another. So acquiring a language is very personal.
How big a difference do you think it makes to have English language learners, as long as they're doing well, as long as they're learning at a solid pace, how important is it to make sure they're with their English-speaking peers sooner rather than later?
Oh, I think it's very important. And you're speaking to someone that doesn't 100% agree with the model. We have educated English language learner in Phoenix Union for many, many years, and we feel that we have done it much more effectively than this model allows us to educate them in. Our kids in the past have had the opportunity to take core content classes while learning a language. The four-hour model is a departure from how we used to educate kids in Phoenix Union who were acquiring a language. So we comply and we do what we're supposed to be doing according to the law. But in my personal opinion, I don't think that this is the best way to educate kids who are acquiring a language.
Evie Cortez-Platenik of the Phoenix Union High School District. Evie, thank you for the time.
You're welcome.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to focus on Syria seems to have raised the stakes in the conflict in eastern Ukraine after there had been an abrupt reduction in hostilities. But Ukraine's economy is still in deep trouble.
And now there are fears the country could face a new source of internal destabilization from demoralized volunteers returning from the front and from frustrated ultranationalists who now oppose President Poroshenko's government. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent Bridget Kendall reports from Kiev.
In a Kiev cafe, at a patriotic poetry evening, they're singing, not always in tune, the national anthem. Outside, having a smoke, we found Grigory, a burly factory worker in his 50s, his T-shirt emblazoned with snarling wolves and a menacing slogan.
It says, death to the enemy. It's a nationalist slogan.
The enemy, he says, is not just Russia, but Ukrainian politicians who are doing deals with Vladimir Putin and failing to flush out corruption.
If there is an enemy, then the enemy should be destroyed. We should wage war, not talk to the enemy.
So you're not a fan of President Poroshenko?
No, of course not.
Poroshenko represents the oligarchs and businessmen instead of the interests of the people, who are the real leaders of the country.
We have gathered today to see.
Poroshenko's reformist ministers, many of them foreign, were out in force at the annual Yes conference on Ukrainian politics. They say they too are trying to take on Ukraine's powerful oligarchs, but it's difficult. Natalie Yaresko, a Ukrainian-American, is Minister of Finance.
I think it's the vested interests that are frustrated right now because we're trying to take away their privileges and create a level playing field. With anti-monopoly policy, all of that is meant to show the average citizen that the average citizen is absolutely important to us, and we are aiming to make their lives easier to the extent possible as well.
But nonetheless, it seems that growing disillusionment with President Poroshenko's government is having alarming consequences. A grenade explosion outside the parliament last month killing three National Guardsmen. It was at a rally organized by the far right, and a fighter from a nationalist volunteer battalion was arrested. It fuels a worry. What if, now the war in the East has stalled, the new danger for Ukraine is from extremists bent on violence inside the country, trying to foment unrest for a new Maidan uprising to topple the government, possibly with the long hand of Moscow behind it. An anthem from Right Sector, one of the most prominent ultra-nationalist movements with its own fighters and party. They resent being the object of suspicion. Their spokesman, Andriy Sharaskin, says any violence is more likely being stirred up deliberately by the government as part of a witch hunt against them.
Yes, in my opinion, that provocation was convenient to the authorities. They benefited the most from it. It gave them an excuse to squeeze the system and introduce additional security measures.
Bells ring out at Mikhailovsky Cathedral, a favorite place for volunteer fighters to gather as they return from the front in the east. Many of the nationalist battalions are being disbanded. The men, one commander told me, are demoralized and angry. Alexei Aristovich is a former intelligence officer with close links to them.
People ask the question, I fought in a war for a year, we achieved nothing, I don't get paid, I haven't been given any medals, and we are repressed and imprisoned, we have weapons, what should we do? Wait to be put in prison one by one? So the mood is very, very radical.
Back at the literary evening, music and poetry evokes patriotic unity. And when it comes down to it, even the most radical voices here, like Grigory, admit they don't really want to bring down the government. Given how fragile Ukraine still is, the country might not survive it.
I think it's a good idea to change the regime at any time, but I don't really know if this will lead to the necessary changes. It's a good idea, but I don't know whether it'll lead to something good.
That's the BBC's Bridget Kendall.
Since the 1970s, U.S. oil producers have been banned from exporting crude oil. The ban was originally put in place in the name of national energy security. Now, with oil prices way down, Congress is debating ending that ban. It's an issue that divides Congress and the oil industry itself. Today, a U.S. Senate committee considers repealing the ban. KJZZ's Lauren Madelon has more on the story from West Texas.
To set the stage, imagine you refine crude oil in this country. You buy the oil at something called WTI, West Texas Intermediate. That's the benchmark price for U.S. crude. WTI is less, sometimes a lot less, than Brent crude, the world's benchmark price. So you buy the discounted U.S. oil, refine it, and sell the finished product to the highest bidder. Here's economist Carrie King at the University of Texas at Austin's Energy Institute.
Right now, because we don't export crude oil, there is what some view as a disproportionate amount of profits going to refiners because they can take in cheaper crude oil in the U.S. and export refined products at a global price for gasoline and diesel.
Naturally, refiners have a different take. This refinery in Big Spring, Texas, would almost certainly lose business were the ban repealed. It's owned by Allon, one of the four U.S. refiners, in a lobby called Consumers and Refiners United for Domestic Energy, or CRUDE. CRUDE's spokesman is Jay Houck. He says maintaining the ban is important for both economic and strategic reasons.
Refining is critical to American energy independence. Without domestic refining, you are relying on foreign countries to turn crude oil into all the different products that we use that are derived from crude oil.
Another group that wants the ban to continue is called Allied Progress. It's a self-styled grassroots lobby running these ads in Colorado, Montana, and New Mexico.
Big Oil is opening their wallet, lobbying Congress to let them ship American crude oil overseas, which could cost U.S. jobs, raise gas prices, and make us more dependent on Middle Eastern oil.
Let's take one of those points. The U.S. government's own data agency, the Energy Information Administration, says gas prices would be unchanged or lower if the export ban ended. Kirk Edwards is an oil producer in the Permian Basin of Texas and New Mexico.
One of the complex things in this whole equation is the refiners are going up against the oil companies on this, but thousands of people that are unemployed in the oil and gas business right now, I think they need to be heard from in these states too.
When U.S. crude's drawn from the ground, it sometimes sits because domestic refineries are backlogged. U.S. refiners are very good at processing heavy, sulfur-laden, sour crude oil because that's what conventional drillings pulled up for decades. But fracking's pulling up a higher grade called light sweet crude. U.S. refiners are adjusting, but producers say not fast enough. The result? Crude in storage waiting to be refined. Another producer, Steve Pruitt, explained what happened when he couldn't get crude to a refinery because of the backlog.
We had to turn off the well because we ran out of storage on our local well site. And in fact, we would even rent frack tanks, as we call them, which are temporary tanks on wheels, to house that crude. And when those filled up, we just shut down the well.
One of the arguments for ending the ban is that the U.S. has a surplus of oil that some call a glut. While it is true that U.S. production has surged, the U.S. still imports millions of barrels of oil every day. Still, ending the ban now could eventually affect a lot of people. Here's Jim Wickland at Credit Suisse in Dallas.
If this was 5 years ago, the only states that would benefit from such a reversal of an old law would be the typical Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma.
But now he says the political calculus has changed.
Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, North and South Dakota, and Wyoming, Colorado, the states where oil production is increasing the fastest, if the oil price were to rebound, and eventually it will, and we still can't export oil, those states will begin to lose jobs and give the growth to other places outside the U.S. as well.
A U.S. House subcommittee has already passed legislation to lift the ban. A full-floor vote in the House is expected next week. Gaining support in the Senate isn't a sure thing. Republican senators in several states with refineries are facing re-election next year. Lorne Madelon, KJZZ News, Midland, Texas.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Valley Traffic. Accidents, I-17 northbound on the Greenway Road on-ramp, I-10 eastbound on the 7th Avenue on-ramp, I-10 eastbound at Southern, and the 101 northbound at Elliott. 103 degrees at KJZZ at 255.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum, presenting the Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei, who recreated 12 bronze sculptures of zodiac creatures as a commentary on the nature of cultural theft and repatriation. Opens October 3rd, phxart.org.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Mike.
My name is Catherine. I'm here at the Deuce. Gonna have an awesome boot camp here on a Sunday morning.
Tons and tons of push-ups until we want to cry.
Six, seven, eight, nine, three and hold.
Can I do all the push-ups that he demands us? No. But I do as many as I can and still get a great workout.
Come on, buddy. Up to the top. Good job. Shake him out.
And then when you think you're done, you're not done. You go back outside and you do more sprints.
Three, two, one, switch. Round two. Let's go.
It ends eventually. The pain is temporary, and I've got a wonderful Bloody Mary waiting for me over here at the bar.
Six, seven, eight, nine, that's 1,000, guys. Good job. Last round, let's do it.
That's Mike Hankinson and Catherine Blaskovich working out in the Punch Crunch Brunch class of the Deuce. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just that we need a little more core work, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. Theater in the Valley is done in big and small spots with big and small casts. Space 55 in Phoenix tends to offer so-called alternative kinds of plays. One of its recurring popular productions is called A Bloody Merry Christmas. The space now has a new artistic director named Dwayne Daniels, who's worked for theater companies in San Diego and Los Angeles. So, Dwayne, why is this a good position and a good creative outlet for you?
This is the kind of a theater that really appeals to me at my core. I like small theater. I like low budgets. I like actors and words.
What's it like being in front of a smaller audience on a smaller stage? Does that make actors look more inward? Does it make actors project more? There's a feeling that sometimes if you're in front of a huge audience, you have to almost overact.
There's an intimacy to it that the audience feels because it really is, you're literally only, you know, several feet from the actors themselves. So it's like you're observing them in real time. You don't have to sit way in the back and pull out your binoculars to see what's going on. You're able to just be right there with the actors in their environment. And it's really immediate and intimate. And you get some of the most powerful theater from that kind of audience perspective.
What kind of shows appeal to you and what sort of shows work better on that small kind of stage?
Well, you know, we are very adventurous and we're also very ambitious. So we don't allow the fact that we're a small theater company to sort of limit our choices too much. We still are pretty ambitious in the types of things that we're choosing. We have a couple of large cast shows this year.
Oh, okay.
We don't feel a need to necessarily be limited by the size of the theater. It is a small venue, but I think that creatively we can create just about anything that we choose to in that venue. And we're looking forward to some really exciting productions this year that are way beyond probably the scope of a small theater company, and yet we're going to do them anyway.
Yeah. What are a couple of those?
Well, we're going to do, of course, we're going to do A Bloody Merry Christmas, which we've done every Christmas for about 4 or 5 years now. I wouldn't dare mess with that part of the programming. It's a huge hit every year. We've added performances in order to accommodate large crowds.
I mean, you didn't get into this profession because you wanted to just do things by the numbers. What's creative and what's really creative, and are you comfortable really pushing the envelope?
It isn't inaccessible. It isn't something like that people might have an image of experimental theater being like indecipherable, et cetera. These are just good, solid stories told, I think, in a somewhat adventurous way. You know, the point of theater is actually to have an effect on your audience and to have them be a little bit changed when they leave. And, you know, to me, I feel like if the audience leaves and they just feel compelled to call their mom, that's enough. It doesn't have to be anything huge. Just you feel like, oh, you know what? I want to call my mom. I want to get back in touch with my sister. I want to, you know, be a better father or husband or son or daughter. Theater is there to help people change for the better.
Dwayne Daniels is the new man in charge of Space 55 in Phoenix. Dwayne, thanks for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. We'll take a look at the competing plans to fund K-12 education in Arizona. And the Suns look to recreate the madhouse on McDowell for one night. Those stories and much more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. The managing editor is Tracy Greer. The news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the uncommon one, Hoban. Thanks very much for listening. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.